This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time to listen to stories from our veterans, we want them to know how much we appreciate their service, their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so our generation and future generations will know how great a price has been paid for our freedom. And our eyes sure are opened along the way. I can certainly say that for myself after 300 episodes of this program now and meeting a veteran a week for close to 9 years. There are some stories that really grab you, those close calls, the extreme conditions survived by prisoners of war, the courage and selflessness these veterans embody. And over the years, some of the most captivating stories have come from some of the Nisei veterans of World War II, young men born in America to Japanese immigrants. And I decided to highlight some of those this week as we approach the annual Day of Remembrance for the Japanese American community. It's held every February because it was on February 19th, 1942, a little more than 2 months after the attack on Pearl Harbor, that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066. That laid the groundwork for what would happen in the weeks and months ahead. Japanese Americans on the West Coast rounded up, taken out of schools, out of jobs, away from property they owned, land that they farmed, and sent to barren internment camps in places like Poston, Arizona, or Topaz, Utah, Jerome, Arkansas. In all, more than 110,000 Japanese Americans were relocated, as the word of choice 70 years ago put it. And we've heard from several of them over the years on Hometown Heroes. Normally, we hear from one veteran for the entire program, and we're going to get back to that format next time with a two-time Olympic gold medalist. But today, let's listen to a little bit from three different men who, along with the rest of the Nisei veterans of World War II, were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal in 2011 in Washington, D.C. Two are California natives, the other grew up in Hawaii. They've all told their stories here on Hometown Heroes, and I thought, what better way to help you focus on the upcoming Day of Remembrance than to listen to some highlights of what these men went through. We'll start with Robert Yano, who grew up in Kingsburg, California, and remembers what life was like before America entered World War II.
My neighbor was Swedish, the Westland family. We stayed there, and we slept over there, and we did everything together. And those days, you know, everybody had a hard time, their parents, our parents. And so we did what you call trading things with a can of milk, cup of sugar, couple of eggs. We just one big family.
I'm guessing you didn't feel like the people of Kingsburg treated you any differently than anybody else.
No, I don't think so. I didn't. No, I didn't think anything about that.
And it probably didn't occur to you that you were all that different, or that at some point your government would decide that because of who you were potential trouble.
I don't think so. No way.
You were trouble for other reasons, I'm sure, which we'll get into that later. But I ask every single veteran that I interview about December 7th, 1941, and I've heard some great stories, but I don't think I've ever talked to anybody who was playing a high school basketball game in Lindsay that day.
I was playing with the Japanese American basketball, you might say, club team that we have.
Oh, okay.
It belonged in Parlor, which they call Young Men's Club.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us had different teams in that area. And that particular day, we were down in Lindsay playing a game. And that's where we picked up the story that Pearl Harbor, and we came back to Parlor, and we were just shocked. We all gathered around and talked about it. And then, of course, we all went our way and went home. But that's where it was kind of a shock when we really heard about it.
Did you sense things starting to change after that day in terms of Kingsburg and the surrounding area?
I think it started to show. It started to show. You had the feeling, and you could just have the feeling. I mean, just something, you know, the feeling of other people. Maybe they thought maybe we had something to do with it. I don't know, but it just, you can feel it. I felt it.
And you hadn't finished high school yet.
No.
But along in February the next year, along comes Executive Order 9066, and President Roosevelt declares that you, somebody who was born here in the United States, that you're an enemy alien and that you have to go to a relocation camp. I can't imagine what that must have felt like. And how did you deal with that?
Well, you know, at senior at high school, you know, it was the law that you had to register for the draft. And I just turned 18. And, of course, that's what I did. So within a week or so, it got a notice from the local board 124 in Fresno. It classified me as 1A, which was eligible for draft.
Mm.
mm-hmm. which is fine with me. That was what we had to do. But when they took us out and sent me to Arizona, to the camp, well, then it was just a week or so after, then I got a notification saying I was reclassified. I opened it up and says I was 4C. Well, that 4C is enemy alien. You know, that's hard to believe that I became an enemy alien. And I talked to my dad, and my dad had one thing over me. He's an alien, but he had a green card, and I was a alien without anything. So it was kind of a dad kind of laughed. We kind of chuckled about it. He told me, he says, well, you're an alien. He says, I got a green card. And he says, well, I know you got one up on me there.
And you brought something with you today that originated from your time there at the Gila River internment camp. It's got all kinds of little red dots on it. It looks like some faded fabric. What's it called, and what's the story behind it?
The story is, this is what you call in Japanese, a sending buddy. Sending buddy means a thousand dots on here. Each dot is put by a lady.
Uh-huh.
And if you wear this around your waist, never take it off, that you'll survive the war and come back.
Mm-hmm.
So while I was in Gila camp, before I was going overseas, a lady came up to me and says, I want you to have this. I want you to wear it. Take it. So I know that your mom isn't here. So I had all these ladies put these dots on for you. I don't know if you knew anything about it, but I heard about it before through Japanese culture.
Sure.
That this is what they wore, the soldiers wore, before they went to the war. They wore it around their waist, never take it off. And I did. And I took it, and I wore it around my waist. And it's unbelievable, but it was around my waist. You couldn't tell whether it was white, blue, black, or what. But when I got out after, I brought it home. At the time after I got married, I showed my wife, and she says, what's that? So I had to explain. She knew what it was about. But she says, well, can't wash it, because if you wash it with real hard soap, it'll take out the dot. So I says, okay. She says, you just wash clear, cold water. And this is what remained. It's still intact as far as the dots are concerned.
That's impressive. I've never seen one of those before. And what does it mean to you now when you see it, when you haven't seen it for a while and your eyes happen to catch it? What does it remind you of? What does it make you think of?
Well, it reminds me of camp. The most regret I have now, and after all that, is not remembering that lady that gave it to me.
Mm.
And I know she meant it from the bottom of her heart, because I'm sure she had kids of her own too, but she brought it to me thinking that, well, this would bring me home. I still take it with me wherever I go and show people this is what it is. And I take it to all the schools, and they're probably in the high school, they're kind of awe, because they just can't believe it. Something like this, you know, has gone, you know, on. You know.
Mm-hmm. That was with you in the Vosges Mountains and everywhere you were with the 442nd.
All the way over and all the way back, up in the mountains, down the mountains, wherever. Yeah.
But so far, you're still in the camp. How did you end up in the military? After you're classified 1A, they change it to 4C, you're stuck there in the camp. How'd you get out?
Well, they opened up and then start opening the draft and whatnot, and this is where I signed up decided, well, this is, I guess this is my part to go, because I was expecting that anyway, you know, and I felt that this is something that I have to do.
Even though you knew that other members of your family would still be stuck there in the camp, you're going to go fight for a government that's doing that to your family.
Yeah, it didn't bother me. I just felt that this is part of it, that mm-hmm. probably maybe this will show that, you know, this is that we are loyal Americans. And one thing I could say, my dad never said it. He just said that you do what you're supposed to do. You were born here. You do what you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Did you understand that you'd be serving in a segregated unit?
Yes. Yes, I knew that.
Was that a good thing, do you think? I mean, did that help to know that the guys around you were in the same boat as you?
Well, I mean, never even gave it a thought about that. Mm-hmm. Just figured that I was going to be in the U.S. Army, and that's it.
So here you are, a 19-year-old BAR man, Browning Automatic Rifle, with the Go for Broke unit, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. Your dad was in the Gila River internment camp, but tell us about what happened to your mother.
My mother went back in July of 41.
Mm-hmm.
The two sisters, Auntie and my mom, went back for a visit. And so they were there, and then they were returning back to the United States. The boat came back to Seattle Way. Halfway, they turned around and went back.
Mm.
And so from the story that we received later on is that my mother got sick, and she had an operation, and they thought it was appendix. It wasn't appendix. It was, I don't know what you'd call it in English, but your intestines, they twist and they do something. Anyway, she passed away there. So,
but you didn't know this at the time.
I didn't know at the time. I was overseas then, and none of us knew. It was probably a year or two later, through the Red Cross, my dad and my brother got the information that she had passed away there. That was the only communication we had. So after the war was over, then I decided that Mom was still there. I didn't know that she was gone. So I says, well, I'll hook up again and maybe I can go to the Pacific and go to chance and go to Japan. Well, in the meantime, my dad and my brother says, well, you come on home. They didn't want to tell me. He says, you come on home first before you go. And so this is what I did. And when I got home, they says, no, there's no use going. Mom has passed away. And then they explained me how she passed away and everything. But that was pretty hard.
Wow. That makes it even more unimaginable for me to put myself in your shoes, knowing that your dad is in a camp. You don't even know where your mom is.
Yeah, correct.
Maybe in a country that your own country is bombing.
Correct.
But here you are out there fighting with all these other Japanese American in a unit that say whatever you want about it. Every superlative you can attach to the 442nd has been attached. The Gopher Broke unit, the most decorated unit of World War II. So many casualties. And you're one of the fortunate ones. You were never wounded during the war.
No, I didn't.
You must be pretty shifty. You must be able to
avoid. Well, I'll tell you, I had a big log over my hole every time I dug in.
It's well documented, the extreme casualties suffered by your unit, the 442nd in World War II. What would you say was your closest call, the time where you thought for sure this was going to be it for you?
Well, I think that's just where one of my squad men right behind me, he was dug in, and he got hit, and it was just, well, he just got hit, and he's blown apart. I mean, you couldn't find anything. So they had to pick him up by pieces. And another fellow right behind me, dug in. He got hit behind, but he didn't. He survived, but he got a shrapnel, real serious shrapnel wound.
Of course, the Gopher Broke soldiers of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team have become legendary for their courage, the signature event being the rescue of the Lost Battalion near the French-German border in October 1944. That's when 230 mostly Caucasian soldiers were rescued by the Japanese-American unit. The 442nd suffered over 800 casualties in saving those surrounded 230. In all, over 3,700 soldiers from the 442nd were wounded during the war, 650 of them killed. What do you think you guys proved?
Maybe we proved we're good Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I always proved that I'm a good American.
Amen. You know, one of the first Nisei veterans that I had the privilege of interviewing was a guy who actually introduced me to the fig and my love for figs because he grew them, a guy by the name of Ike Ikeda or Fumio Ikeda, if you're pronouncing it the correct Japanese way.
Yeah.
And Ike is gone now, but one of the things that he said, I heard him say so often, that he wanted to prove that his blood was just as red as all the other Americans. You think that happened?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's true on that. Yeah, I think he did a good job on that one, yeah.
What about the significance of that slogan, Gopher Broke? When you think about Gopher Broke, what does that mean to you? And what did it mean to you then?
It means go all out, all you can do.
And why was that the mentality?
I don't know, just
because you had nothing to lose?
Gopher Broke, don't lose. Dude.
Your families are already held captive.
Yeah.
I mean, what else are they going to do to them, right? You got to prove it somehow. And there was something from your Japanese culture, a word in Japanese that you'd heard spoken around the home that kind of became your mantra for the war. What was that?
It's gaman. Gaman.
And what does that mean?
That means you just have to take it, whether you like it or not. You just take it. Gaman. You just.
And it becomes kind of a test of your will and your character, how much you can take.
That's right. You can take a lot. Human body can take a lot.
I bet you didn't plan on taking as much as you did.
No, but it's a necessity, you might say, sometimes.
Well, he took it, and he shared some of that with us. You can find that entire interview, originally conducted in 2011, on hometownheroesradio.com. When we come back, we're going to shift to another Nisei veteran story. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
One of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that their real sincerity and a genuine spirit are things that really make an impression on me. And that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years. I've heard them say it's all about serving their members, and then I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, EECU demonstrates over and over again what 200,000 members already know. EECU takes you personally. Go to myeecu.org to find out for yourself, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing this week on Japanese Americans who served our country during World War II, many doing so while their families were held in internment camps. We listened to some of Robert Yano's story. He's from Kingsburg, where he served as Grand Marshal of the famed Swedish Festival last year. But the next snippet here comes from Clarence Suzuki, who grew up a long way from Central California.
But she was bleeding, and then that was my first exposure to what happened on that day, December 7th. But the firemen told us to go home and just stay there and listen to the radio. So I went home.
Well, and for people who haven't visited Honolulu, I'm just picturing in my mind. Now, Pearl Harbor is a couple miles west of what you're talking about. These are the streets of Honolulu, closer to Waikiki, just north of the beaches of Waikiki. In fact, I'll never look at that intersection the same now that you've told me that story. So this is not where all the boats or anything are. This is far away from what the attacks there. Had you had any indication before that something like this could happen? How big of a shock was it?
Well, in 1940, I think my recollection may not be historically correct, but during the summer of 1941, you know, now and then we were out to Waikiki Beach. Next door was Kuhio Beach. Waikiki was for the tourists. Kuhio Beach was for the locals. But during the summer, maybe twice a week we'd be out there swimming, and I would notice that the aircraft carriers were out there on the horizon. Sometimes three, sometimes none. But my understanding in 1941 summer was the islands were on red alert already. And if you read about December 7th, there's no acknowledgement that the islands were on red alert. But my recollection is that we were on red alert, namely because in the summer of 1940, Rear Admiral, he was one of the intelligence chiefs in Washington, but he said that Japan might attack Pearl Harbor. But in June of 1941, he says Japan is most likely to attack Pearl Harbor. So that's the kind of historic, background that I have, but most of the media never acknowledged that the islands were on red alert.
Well, I guess it probably wasn't politically expedient at the time because they wanted it to play out as a sneak attack, and that would get America together in a different way. I'm curious, as someone who was Japanese-American living on the island of Oahu, did you know immediately that it was Imperial Japan that had attacked, and did it strike you that this might be tough to be a Japanese-American on that island after the attacks?
Yes. After I saw the explosion and the fire on Macaulay and King, the firemen told us to go home, stay there. So within a couple of days, message from the authorities was to stay indoors, don't turn on the lights at night. But it turns out that everybody wondered what happened on the Macaulay and King fire, explosion and fire. As it turned out, Pearl Harbor anti-aircraft guns were shooting at the planes. And some of the shells did not detonate as they were supposed to up in the air. They came down on the ground and exploded. And the same thing was in the city of Honolulu. My understanding was about 260 civilians were killed by our own artillery fire, the bombs exploding in the city of Honolulu.
And you came, I guess, fairly close to being another one added to that tally. How far away were you from these explosions and that fire?
Oh, that fire in Macaulay, I was only about a block away, pretty close. See, because I was going to the Olivet Baptist Church for Bible training, but we had to go early and meet at my friend's house, and that was the location that was so close to the bomb. But the church was only another block, Mauka, you know, north, where we were meeting at the Suemori's house.
So in the wake of this, I mean, and as America found out, and everyone who I've ever interviewed has a memory of how they first found out about these attacks, you found out before just about anybody because you were right there. But in the weeks and the months that followed, what was life like there? And when did you realize that your life might end up changing a little bit?
Well, we just had to stay indoors. The instructions were coming over the radio that you should, you know, dig a bomb shelter. And every home would be supplied with some lumber or whatever to make a bomb shelter. So my father and I, we had to pick and shovel in the front yard to build a bomb shelter. But it was kind of messy too because, you know, all that, you know, dirt and stuff like that, and you had to have lumber to cover up the sort of a tunnel that you dug, just barely, you know, enough for a couple of three people. After that, you had to put the black cloth over the windows, and you couldn't have any light shining at night. But we managed. We got some black cloth and some low incandescent lamps. We managed to be in a blackout. And then the school said, yeah, we're going to be school coming out. But this was now around February of 1942. So all the kids went back to school. From that point on, I think the military was, you know, getting more and more secure about Japan not attacking and landing in the Hawaiian Islands.
And that's the thing. I don't want to look past that because we know now that Japan didn't come back and conquer the islands as they might have been able to had they struck at the right time. But it must have been a constant state of fear for you there, having seen what they did on December 7th, that they might come back. How did you deal with that?
Well, we all worried about that, you know, that the Japan armed forces might return. But in the meantime, the military governor, General Emmons, allowed the University of Hawaii ROTC guys to form the Victory Volunteer Soldiers. And there was another group of Niseis that were already in the U.S. Army. They got booted out. And there was another group in the Territorial Guard. So these three groups formed later on the nucleus of the 100th Infantry Battalion. School started, and we tried to get back to normalcy, but things were not normal. I mean, we didn't have the regular teachers. My teacher, Dr. Daiho Chan, he was a major, and he didn't come back to school because he had a ROTC commission. And we had another teacher called Mrs. Evans. She was not up to snuff. But we managed to, you know, go through all this period. And I graduated from McKinley High School in 1943. At that time, they were asking for volunteers. And I asked my papa, and he said, no, don't go. But the others, they went, like Senator, you know, Dan Inouye. He was a year older than me. I think he was in the university already, but he volunteered. And some of my classmates volunteered also. They became the nucleus of the 442nd. And I met Senator Inouye in Washington.
At this recent Congressional Gold Medal Ceremony in November?
November 2nd, they had kind of a impromptu pre-dinner, you know, get-together. So I met Senator Inouye at the time. And I told Senator, you know, you were in Macaulay in Bingham Track, and I was in Macaulay down on Day Street. And he opened his eyes and said, oh, you know, he didn't say anything. I said, no, you know, Dan, you were in the Troop 36, the Boy Scouts of America, and we met at the YMCA once a month. And Dan only smiled and, you know, he didn't say anything. And then I told Dan, hey, you know, when I went to the university after the war, his wife, Margaret Aramura, was in the teacher's department or whatever, and she was administering the English, spoken English test. So I passed, but my wife Thelma flunked. She had to go to speech lab. But I mentioned that all. I said, Dan, you know, I also know that some of your, you know, guys in the 442 were my classmates. One was Thomas Jichaku. He was killed in action in Anzio. And Shigeru Kanemoto, he was with Dan earlier, I guess, but I don't know what outfit he was in. Then there's Archie Sokin, my classmate, also Flash Nakagawa. I don't know what happened to these guys, too. Dan only smiled. He never said anything.
He probably got a lot of those conversations that week in Washington. But what I hear, and so you had been in the same Boy Scout troop with him all these years before, and it sounds like you were just saying that you thought about joining at a time where you would have ended up in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. That's not what your destiny would be in the military. We'll talk about that in a minute. But have you ever wondered how different your life would have been had you ended up with the 442nd?
Yeah, I often wondered about that because, you know, the guys that went in there, they took some heavy, you know, getting killed and everything. I often thought about that too. I said I was fortunate that, in a way, I didn't go to Europe, but instead it's because of my language training that after I took my basic training in Scofia Barracks, they had a Japanese language school established there. Most people didn't know, whatever. And she was administering the English, spoken English test. So I passed, but my wife Thelma flunked. She had to go to speech lab. But I mentioned that all. I said, Dan, you know, I also know that some of your, you know, guys in the 442 were my classmates. One was Thomas Jichaku. He was killed in action in Anzio. And Shigeru Kanemoto, he was with Dan earlier, I guess, but I don't know what outfit he was in. Then there's Archie Sokin, my classmate. Also Flash Nakagawa. I don't know what happened to these guys, too. Dan only smiled. He never said anything.
He probably got a lot of those conversations that week in Washington. But what I hear, and so you had been in the same Boy Scout troop with him all these years before, and it sounds like you were just saying that you thought about joining at a time where you would have ended up in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. That's not what your destiny would be in the military. We'll talk about that in a minute. But have you ever wondered how different your life would have been had you ended up with the 442nd?
Yeah, I often wondered about that because, you know, the guys that went in there, they took some heavy, you know, getting killed and everything. I often thought about that too. I said I was fortunate that, in a way, I didn't go to Europe, but instead it's because of my language training that after I took my basic training in Scofia Barracks, they had a Japanese language school established there. Most people didn't know. But this language school, I attended about a month, and then this Navy, Lieutenant J.G. came by, and he was interviewing a lot of the guys that was in the school. And I apparently passed the language test because I was the only guy that he sent me to Tinian. The rest of them went to Okinawa. But it's because of my spoken language proficiency. Before the war, I went to 8th grade in a Japanese language school. It was for at least 1.5 hours after English school. So it was basically 3 o'clock to about 5 o'clock, plus 3 hours on Saturday morning. So I had a good command of the spoken language. But the kanji, the Chinese characters, I wasn't that good at. But the Navy was looking for people that could speak the language. See, we had to, interrogate, interpret.
And I don't want to make a leap here, but as I just think about this in retrospect and know where you did end up, and not that it was a cakewalk what you experienced, but if you didn't have those language skills, if you hadn't been that dedicated in your schoolwork and learning the Japanese language and other situations, then you might have ended up somewhere else. The language skills you had may have ended up saving your life. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's a fair estimate because if I didn't pass that test, I would have probably gone overseas, maybe back to Italy or someplace. Sometimes being smart, you know, might be helpful.
So you served as an interrogator and interpreter in the Pacific, places like Saipan and Tinian, where you'd even see the famed Enola Gay. But when it comes to Japanese Americans in World War II, a lot of people have heard about the 442nd, what they did in Europe. Do you ever run into people who are surprised that you served in the Pacific because they haven't heard of the MIS or didn't know that Japanese Americans were involved in that part of the war?
Yeah, most of my friends didn't know that the MIS was in the Pacific, namely because until the Freedom of Information Act 1976, most people didn't know we were out there in the Pacific, attached to the Marines, attached to the Army, attached to the Australian, British armies, Indian army. More recently, information is coming out that we were out there. We were in every major battle in the Pacific. Most Americans know the 442 served in Italy and France, but I would say only 10% of the Americans know that the Nisei were out in the Pacific in every major battle.
Well, hopefully we're helping a few more people understand that today. Well, as we wrap up the show, I just want to thank you for serving our country and thank you for sharing some of those stories with us.
Thank you very much, Paul. I appreciate you interrogating me.
The tables are turned.
Yes. Thank you so much.
That was Clarence Suzuki. You can tap into that entire interview also at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, yet another Nisei veteran we've had the privilege of listening to on Hometown Heroes as we enter a week where the internment is remembered. We'll be right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing on Japanese American veterans today. Every February, there is a day of remembrance. So the internment of more than 110,000 Japanese Americans 70 years ago is not forgotten. All three of the men you're hearing from today were in Washington, D.C. in 2011 when the Nisei veterans of World War II received the Congressional Gold Medal. We've heard from one from California, one from Hawaii. Here's another San Joaquin Valley native, Sherman Kishi of Livingston. That's in Merced County. And it was easy to take him right back to the days of the internment because he still lives on the same piece of land where he grew up. Here comes another example of life interrupted.
We had at the high school.
What happened?
Well, the family that lived where we live now, this place here, they moved out after 9066 when the Japanese people still move out of state. And they were going to go live with a daughter that lived in Denver.
So for folks who don't know, Executive Order 9066 was President Roosevelt in February of 42 saying that Japanese people on the West Coast had to be evacuated and sent to different internment camps. So these folks here moved out.
Yes. Of course, the 9066 didn't say that. It actually gave the Western Defense Commander the right to do what he thought was right to protect the security of the West Coast. So after the family moved, they sent me a letter, asked for me to pick up their fishing gear because they were going to go fishing in Colorado. And so I came to the house or the garage where the fishing gear was, and I took it home and I sent it off to them. And the person that was running the ranch here for them was one of the teachers, and he just really got onto me at school and was not pleasant at all. And so that was one of the incidents that happened.
So you started to notice people's attitudes toward you and other Japanese Americans change a little bit?
I think it changed a little bit. We went on to school after 9066 until about May. And then in May of that year, 1942, the orders came out, and there were posters on the telephone poles and fence posts that told us that we had to go to an assembly center. At that stage, we quit school and got prepared to have to leave. So that's what happened during that period of time.
And you tell that very matter-of-factly, but I'm sure at the time that was quite a shock to you and had to be pretty emotional to be a 17-year-old kid and being told the place you've lived your whole life, you're not welcome anymore.
Yeah, it was very much so. It was particularly difficult, I think, for our parents. You have to remember that our parents were quite young yet. Many of the parents were in their late 40s and in their 50s. And so they were in the prime of their life, and they had farmed here all their lives, and all of a sudden everybody had to leave. So I know that once this had happened, they became so fearful of anything that was Japanese that I remember anything that we had in the house that looked a little bit Japanese-y, as much as we could, we destroyed, buried, or burned. And that happened to all the families in the area. So that's the kind of thing that happened during that period of time, yeah. And, you know, interestingly, they gave us this notice about 3 weeks before we had to go. The day that we went on was my 17th birthday, so I remember it very vividly. This was May the 13th of 1942, and that's the day we went into the Assembly Center in Merced.
Which is where the Merced County Fairgrounds are now?
Yes, it's where the fairground is now. We have put up a monument there in memory of that with all the names of the people that are on a wall. So that's where we got sent in. And I remember mostly being put onto buses at our church. And then we went on the bus to Merced. And we went to the, it used to be the armory there, right on 17th Street, and it's still there. And they took us there, and the first time we got there, we got out of the bus right in front, and there was a gentleman who was a dentist from San Francisco that spoke to us and told us that we had to behave and do what they asked us to do, and basically that's what we did and went into the Assembly Center, which was mostly prepared at that time.
How scared and unsettled were you? Because, I mean, that seems like a pretty imposing and uncertain future you were facing.
You know, when you're young like that, you don't think of that as much. But I'm sure that the parents were very upset. For some of us who were at that age, were young teenagers yet, it was sort of fun because we never met so many Japanese people in our lives. And very shortly after going into the camp, we had some very well-educated people who had gone to college, unable to get jobs because jobs weren't available to people of Japanese descent. And so they were well-educated, and they immediately started things within the camp. And one of the things that started was baseball. And baseball became a very popular pastime in Merced Assembly Center as it was in the later relocation camps. So there were things like talent shows. I remember very vividly one talent show that we went to that had a young lady from Walnut Grove who had a beautiful contralto voice, and one of the most popular songs that was sung at the time was God Bless America. Can you imagine? Yeah, that's what happened during those days, yeah.
And the irony, huh? God Bless America when you're basically being held prisoner by America.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But we didn't think of it that way, I guess, clearly. You know, I was playing tennis in high school, and I was on the high school team, and so we practiced a lot of tennis. And this was early Sunday morning. There were four of us that went to play at the high school tennis courts to try to improve our game. And we were playing at the high school tennis courts, and as we were playing there, a car stopped by the side of the road. There were two or three men in the car, I don't remember, but they opened their windows and started to curse at us and call us all kinds of names, and it just really made us feel bad. And so, of course, we quit very shortly and went home and came home. And when we came home, we heard on the radio that Pearl Harbor had happened. And that was a change for all the United States and all the world, really, basically. But I think maybe a little bit more for some of us of Japanese ancestry in the United States.
You were born here. Did you have family in Japan that you were in contact with at all?
You know, of course, I was young yet. I was 16 years old when this happened. And my father and mother used to have contact with the family in Japan, but we had never, ever seen them, only heard of them occasionally. And I think my mother went to visit the family way back in 1934, but my father had never gone back to Japan, but he was still in communication with them. So, yes, most of our relatives were in Japan.
When you went to school the next day, what was that like, the day after Pearl Harbor?
You know, the day after Pearl Harbor is a difficult one to remember, but I don't think anything really basically happened at school. The kids were okay. They didn't bother us particularly. Later, as we continued in school, though, there were some incidents that became very onerous to us, and one of them was with one of the teachers that we had at the high school.
What happened?
Well, the family that lived where we live now, this place here, they moved out after 9066 when the Japanese people could still move out of state. And they were going to go live with a daughter that lived in Denver.
So for folks who don't know, Executive Order 9066 was President Roosevelt in February of 42 saying the Japanese people on the West Coast had to be evacuated and sent to different internment camps. So these folks here moved out.
Yes. Of course, the 9066 didn't say that. It actually gave the Western Defense Commander the right to do what he thought was right to protect the security of the West Coast. So after the family moved, they sent me a letter, asked for me to pick up the fishing gear because they were going to go fishing in Colorado. And so I came to the house or the garage where the fishing gear was, and I took it home and I sent it off to them. And the person that was running the ranch here for them was one of the teachers, and he just really got onto me at school and was not pleasant at all. And so that was one of the incidents that happened.
So you started to notice people's attitudes toward you and other Japanese Americans change a little bit?
I think it changed a little bit. We went on to school after 9066 until about May. And then in May of that year, 1942, the orders came out, and there were posters on the telephone poles and fence posts that told us that we had to go to an assembly center. At that stage, we quit school and got prepared to have to leave. So that's what happened during that period of time.
And you tell that very matter-of-factly, but I'm sure at the time that was quite a shock to you and had to be pretty emotional to be a 17-year-old kid and being told the place you've lived your whole life, you're not welcome anymore.
Yeah, it was very much so. It was particularly difficult, I think, for our parents. You have to remember that our parents were quite young yet. Many of the parents were in their 40s, late 40s, and in their 50s. And so they were in the prime of their life, and they had farmed here all their lives, and all of a sudden, everybody had to leave. So I know that once this had happened, they became so fearful of anything that was Japanese that I remember anything that we had in the house that looked a little bit Japanesey, as much as we could, we destroyed, buried, or burned. And that happened to all the families in the area. So that's the kind of thing that happened during that period of time. Yeah. And, you know, interestingly, they gave us this notice about 3 weeks before we had to go. The day that we went on was my 17th birthday. So I remember it very vividly. This was May the 13th of 1942. And that's the day we went into the assembly center in Merced.
Which is where the Merced County Fairgrounds are now?
Yes, it's where the fairground is now. We have put up a monument there in memory of that with all the names of the people that are on a wall. So that's where we got sent in. And I remember mostly being put onto buses at our church. And then we went on the bus to Merced. And we went to the, it used to be the armory there, right on 17th Street, and it's still there. And they took us there, and the first time we got there, we got out of the bus right in front, and there was a gentleman who was a dentist from San Francisco that spoke to us and told us that we had to behave and do what they asked us to do, and basically that's what we did and went into the assembly center, which was mostly prepared at that time.
How scared and unsettled were you? Because, I mean, that seems like a pretty imposing and uncertain future you were facing.
You know, when you're young like that, you don't think of that as much. But I'm sure that the parents were very upset. For some of us who were at that age, were young teenagers yet, it was sort of fun because we never met so many Japanese people in our lives. And very shortly after going into the camp, we had some very well-educated people who had gone to college, unable to get jobs because jobs weren't available to people of Japanese descent. And so they were well-educated, and they immediately started things within the camp. And one of the things that started was baseball. And baseball became a very popular pastime in Merced Assembly Center as it was in the later relocation camps. So there were things like talent shows. I remember very vividly one talent show that we went to that had a young lady from Walnut Grove who had a beautiful contralto voice, and one of the most popular songs that was sung at the time was God Bless America. Can you imagine? Yeah, that's what happened during those days, yeah.
And the irony, huh? God Bless America when you're basically being held prisoner by America.
That's exactly right. Yeah, But we didn't think of it that way, I guess.
They sent you off to a camp in Colorado, and when they were taking volunteers for the 442nd, you were too young. Eventually, you signed up for the Military Intelligence Service, and before you ever got deployed, you spent 9 months studying the Japanese language, staying up at night with a flashlight in the latrine to study so you could pass those tests. What made you so driven to serve this country that had uprooted you from your home?
I didn't think about that very much, frankly. This was our country. This is the only country that we knew, and this is the only country we're loyal to. All we thought about was doing what we needed to do for our own country. We knew that Japan, our folks came from Japan, but that really didn't cut any ice with us because we never knew any of those people over there. And so they became our enemies, basically.
You went overseas, you came home, you married the girl you'd met on a trip to the World's Fair in San Francisco in 1939. You and June are still married all these years later. Others in the community took care of your land while your family was in the camp, so you picked back up. You're still farming in Livingston. You've been to Washington, D.C., received that Congressional Gold Medal with other Nisei veterans. You've helped establish physical reminders of the internment with the beautiful Merced Assembly Center Memorial. And now you have kids, you have grandkids. What is it that you hope they learn and remember about what Japanese Americans endured during World War II?
I think that the thing that they will probably learn is that this country, which is unique in the world, I think, is able to do things to right what was done that was wrong at the particular time. And this country did do that for us. They righted the wrong when they had the redress action back in 1988. There was a lot of activity that went into that. It took 10 years before this happened. There were many congressional hearings and things that went on. But at that time, they gave an apology to us for letting that happen. And, of course, they gave us some redress as well. They gave us each $20,000 as a result of the relocation that they did. And one of the things that I prize the most is the apology that came from President Bush, because he was the president at the time that they sent the letters out. So I hope that the children will look at that and realize what a great country we have.
Well, that seems like the perfect way to wrap things up today. I know it was a little different, working in three different stories. And if you want to hear more, you can find those full interviews online. Maybe you'll take the time to take part in Day of Remembrance observances in the week ahead in your hometown. I'm sure you've noticed the Olympics have begun. Next time, we're going to listen to a two-time Olympic gold medalist who also happens to be a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, having served for 26 years. I'll look forward to sharing that story with you as we learn once more that no matter where you live in this great country, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. And their stories remind us every time that freedom is not free.